Coach, are you still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.
It taught me a lot about you got to have the humility to understand that you don't know everything and you can't do everything. It's just too much.
On this episode of the Rising Coaches podcast, we're joined by Alex Barlow, Division I assistant coach and former G League head coach. Barlow's journey started as a player at Butler before moving into the NBA with the Boston Celtics, where he worked his way up from the video room to the bench and eventually became the head coach of the Maine Celtics. He later returned to the college level at Butler, continuing to grow his coaching career. In this episode, we discuss his path through the NBA and G League, including what he learned while rising through the Celtics organization, a breakdown of Boston's unique offensive rebounding and transition defense concepts, and what he's doing now as he prepares for his next opportunity.
Welcome back, coaches and everyone. Thank you for tuning in. Another episode of the Rising Coaches podcast. Alan Major, Doug Caputo here today. We're graced to be able to have the opportunity to sit down, former Division I assistant, worked in the NBA, G League head coach, ladies and gentlemen, Alex Barlow. Coach Barlow, welcome.
Thanks, guys, for having me. I'm excited to be back on the pod. And I'm really looking forward to talking hoops.
Yeah, we appreciate it, brother. Thank you.
Now, I know we've got a chance to chop it up with you before on our roundtable. It's great to be able to get more of an inner, a personal side of things, just to get to talk about your background, your experiences that you've had, which you've had some great experiences. You've experienced the side of growing in a program as a player, which, of course, is unique, being a walk-on at Butler and then ultimately going up to somebody who ends up seeing some time where nothing was guaranteed, to then later on being a young coach trying to establish yourself on a staff, growing in various programs, Boston Celtics, as well as Butler. But the experiences of having to earn everything as a player, has that shaped really the way you approached the coaching profession? Like when you were first getting into it, did it really give you an idea as how to grow in a program? Talk about those experiences.
Yeah, I think because I had to grind my way from a walk-on to playing and starting on an NCAA tournament team, I just have a unique perspective in terms of work and what it takes. When I got to Butler, I wasn't very good as a basketball player, and I got to see some of the more experienced guys, Rodney Clark, how he worked, and I was able to learn from that. I just put a lot of time in, basically committed myself to becoming the best player I could. And then when I got to Boston, I was in the video room, and anybody who's been in an NBA video room, especially back then when you have to cut 4 or 5 games a night, it's a grind. It's a lot like being a walk-on. You're doing a lot of grunt work. You're doing a lot of things that nobody will ever see. Nobody ever knows how important it is. And because of my experience being a walk-on, it allowed me to understand that work will eventually pay off. And I eventually became a G League head coach there, which was an awesome experience. But I don't think I would have probably understood how hard you had to work or what it took to go from a video guy in the NBA to being a G League head coach if I didn't have that experience as a walk-on at Butler.
Yeah, no, I think the thing I, you know, noticed being around you and getting to know you is, and this probably was part of that grind as a player and kind of having to fight and scrap your way into a starting lineup, but you're always in a constant pursuit of trying to find an edge. And I think, talk about that, because I think that is directly probably affected and influenced you as a coach, is that you're always on the hunt to try to find an edge, because you had to do that as a player in order to find your way to the court.
Yeah. When I played, I always remember this, when we made the NCAA tournament my sophomore year, we were going to play Bucknell, and I don't believe I'd been starting. Me and Kellen Dunham had been kind of going back and forth, and I was so excited to play the NCAA tournament. I watched literally every single turnover Bucknell had offensively, because they were like number one in the country at fewest turnovers. And I end up starting the game. I have 4 steals. And I remember Coach Stevens telling me that the reason he started me is because he knew I was in that office. How much I'd been in the office is watching film, preparing for the game. And to your point about coaching, that's kind of how I'm as a coach, right? When I was running the offense the last 3 years at Butler, I'd be combing through film, trying to find what ways can we give our team an advantage that maybe these other teams haven't been able to figure out. So I think that was just instilled in me early as a player. And then, so when I got into coaching, it was something I've already accustomed to doing. And it's something that was really useful in my time at Butler.
Yeah. Work ethic. Obviously this could be a hot take, but I feel like you can have a work ethic, but I really truly feel like it's something that is brought up around you because you see it, you watch it. A lot of times people say, oh, this kid has a work ethic. It's probably because they've seen his parents develop a work ethic or have a strong work ethic. And then they ultimately get it as a kid, similar to your situation, being around, you've had some of the greatest coaches that you've played and coached alongside, Coach Mata, right? Congratulations to him, obviously, for his retirement and everything now, but then obviously over it in Boston and even your playing experience, Coach Stevens. What did really having those two as role models, people to be able to play for, coach alongside, what did you learn about them that separated those two from the majority?
Yeah, I'd say for Brad, I have the unique experience of playing and coaching with him, which I got to see both sides of it. His attention to detail, both as a coach from when we were in Boston, scheduling the flights, the practices, what he wanted to do each day, right? That stuff wasn't just made up the day before. He had that planned out from, I don't know, August, July. We would meet in summer league to talk about the plan for basically the next 3 months. And so his detail, attention to detail as a coach. And then when we played, we always saw him in the office watching film. He'd always bring us in talking X's and O's. And then so when he would come up with these game plans sometimes that you might seem a little crazy or unique, we had a ton of confidence that they were going to work just because we knew, one, the amount of time he put in, and two, he would always talk about it with us and always explain the why. And I thought that was super important. And then for Thad, Mage knows this, Thad's as good of a player's coach as you're going to find. In 3 years at Butler, through the NIL era, through the transfer portal era, there was not a single player that did not like playing for coach. And that's very unique, especially in this era. He has an unbelievable ability to motivate the guys. He has some interesting ways in which he does it. But we never, maybe in 3 years, there might have been two games where it just felt like we didn't have it or we didn't play hard. And that's really hard in this era, especially for a team that wasn't probably winning as much as we would all have liked. Guys showed up every day and practiced hard. Some days he'd be more relaxed, more casual. Then other days he would understand that, hey, they don't quite have it right now. And he would light a fire into them early and practice would flip and guys would be going hard. And I don't know if he's the best at it, but I haven't seen coach played with anybody that was better than Coach Mata was at knowing his volume of his team and of his players and getting them to the volume that he wanted every single day.
Yeah, well said, man. Absolutely. He had a great feel for the temperature, no doubt. He could be a thermometer and a thermostat at the same time.
I would say that's a tough thing to do, is to be able to gauge everybody's, like where everybody's at, but then not only gauge it, then you have to, okay, these guys aren't here today. I got to find a way to push them. And it's like that right there is knowing the players, because one person might not take a kick in the behind and be like, all right, yeah, they might take it differently than everybody else. I remember my coach would always, he was a more old school style coach. He knew we all really relied on our point guard. He was our best player. He threw our point guard out of a practice one game, just threw him out completely. No reason whatsoever. The kid threw one pass, threw him out. We're all sitting there like, later on, learned that's exactly what he was doing. He saw we were having a rough practice, threw our point guard out. And then it, like, after we graduated, it was one of those joking stories that, but he found a way to light a fire under everybody else because he knew everybody else was going to fall in line for that. So what are some things that, like, or were there any unique ways that Coach Mata would just really light everybody up? And
not necessarily like lighting guys up, but we'd be in film, right? And he would just be like, he would tell a story or tell about a time at Ohio State or Xavier or with all the NBA guys he coached, right? I remember back in 2016 with D'Angelo Russell, right? And he would tell a story about that and relate it to whatever the message or the point he wanted to get across. And when you're dealing with college kids these days, they all think they're going to go play in the NBA. And so when you're able to relate it to somebody was a national player of the year, number two pick in the draft, has had a long NBA career, it's going to catch their attention, right? It's really going to catch their attention and they're going to really listen. And your message is going to get across because of that. And a lot of that had to do with the guys that he coached before him. And he was able to come up to tell stories or tell times that they were in the exact same situation and how it related. And honestly, it almost always got our guys' attention, because when you're talking about some of the greats that he coached, you would not be the smartest person in the world if you didn't listen to what he was saying.
No, and I think that's having a great balance of, like you said, he could do it in a way where it wasn't demeaning. He wasn't throwing a hand grenade into the room, but he found a way to get his point across. But I think one of the best things that it sounds like he and Brad both had this is the ability, when you have the ability and the confidence as a head coach to delegate.
Yeah.
It takes great confidence and obviously and great humility to do that and just say, hey, you guys take this segment of practice. You have this segment, but then that allows you to manage the group a little bit easier because you're not worried about handling every single thing yourself, or you don't have to be the main voice every day on the court for two straight hours. When you're able to kind of delegate and pass the ball as a head coach, for lack of a better phrase, I think that allows you to manage the group. And again, like we talk about temperature taking, I think it allows you to do those things.
No, that's great, especially working with two people like that. But obviously, we're here to talk about yours, so I didn't want to make it diluted too much with their background. But I obviously have had great people that you have worked for, so it definitely has helped instill to who you are and how you coach, I'm sure. With your successes, as we mentioned, you were a player at Butler. You go on to the Boston Celtics, then end up going into the Maine Celtics, which are all ultimately the same thing, just the G League for the Boston. But with that, you have grown from not only on the video side of things to then being a head coach with Boston and with Maine. So that right there, and that's why I like to say how you growing from a walk-on to ultimately being a team helping go to the NCAA tournament to then being a video on the video side of things, growing to be a head coach for the Celtics, but Maine. But with that, talk about what you learned in that head coach position, right? Being a head coach, growing first off into a program to then being a head coach for Maine. I know you guys had a 30 win season, a playoff appearance. So it's not like it wasn't just anything. You guys had a great experience and great time. Talk about that experience growing in the program and then being the head coach.
Yeah, I think you learn a lot being a chair down, being an assistant. But I thought I was going to get the job in the 21-22 season, but then Brad went into the front office, Danny left, we brought in Ime. And ultimately, they hired a guy named Jarrell Christian. And at the time, I was pretty hurt. I felt like I deserved a chance to be the head coach. But in all reality, it was probably the best thing for me. I got to work with Jarrell, who was an unbelievable culture guy. He's an unbelievable leader. When he allowed me to grow so much because of the responsibility he gave me, to Mage's point about delegating, right? And Thad was a great delegator. Brad was a great delegator. And Jarrell just kind of let me run with the development, the offensive side of it. But he also taught me a lot about culture. And one of his big things was like gratitude, right? Every day we'd go around the circle and he'd pick out one guy and they would have to say what they were thankful for. And we'd always say gratitude. And what that taught me was, and it's very applicable, I think, to the NIL and transfer stuff now, is like when I was 5 years old, I wanted to be a basketball coach. So I should have tons of gratitude that I get to coach for the Boston Celtics, the greatest organization in the NBA, right? And sometimes that gets lost, right? You have long-term personal goals and sometimes you don't reach them. The gratitude that you had when you were 5 years old, or you would have had when you were 5 years old, you lose it, right? And so that year was really big for my development. It taught me a lot about being a head coach from a non-X's and O's side, but how to delegate, how to manage a team, how to manage players better. And then so when I took over the next year, I felt like I was way more prepared than I probably would have been going into that season. And with somebody that is super like go-getter, a guy as a player that was like super aggressive and like I just went and got everything on my own, right? I just went and made myself into a player. As a head coach, I don't think you can do that, right? You have to delegate to your staff. You have to allow your staff to spread their wings, to have a voice. And so having that experience the year before with Jarrell, it really allowed me to do that in Maine. And then the other thing was, the first thing I wanted to do when I was a head coach is I wanted to hire somebody that I thought would challenge me and somebody that could keep me accountable, somebody that wouldn't allow me just to do whatever I felt like I wanted to do. Ultimately, in the end, as a head coach, it's your decision. But I hired Ross McMaines, who's now with the Celtics. He's been all over the world. Super great basketball mind, super good friend of mine. And I told him, I said, don't allow me just to do what I want to do. Challenge me. If you don't like something we're doing, tell me, call me out. Don't allow me just to be comfortable. And I thought the year with Jarrell, learning how to be thankful for everything and run a team and manage a team, and then hiring Ross, who basically we had some conversations in there where we would be going at it, right? He's, I don't think we should be doing this. I don't like this. And it was good for me because it allowed me to see the game from a different lens. And so I think that was a huge part of our success. I had great coaches in Maine, hired a couple former players, Luis Flores, J.R. Reynolds, who's now at Nebraska Omaha. And those guys had a unique experience because they played professionally. And so I thought the hiring of the staff was such an important thing for me, and then delegating the roles within my staff. And we won 30 games, made the playoffs, and had a successful year.
Yeah. No, great stuff, man.
That's one of those things where I've learned, and I feel like I've learned this because I'm grateful as ever to be able to have this opportunity to talk to people, learn from other coaches. And the one thing that everybody always says, and Mage, correct me if I'm wrong here, it's whenever somebody's a head coach, they always say the toughest thing to do is to delegate. And I feel like a lot of that starts with not necessarily because they don't want to delegate, but because they have too much pride in what they do that they don't want to push it off. And, oh, I know I have the work ethic. They don't want to delegate to other people. That is one thing that, as everybody has mentioned, it's great that you say that because it obviously it challenged you. It allowed you to grow as a coach, and it tells that you have utmost confidence in yourself. But to put somebody who's next to you to challenge you on a day-to-day basis, not a lot of people would do that. So that right there says a lot. That's definitely impressive.
I think the great thing AB just said is, and I made this mistake as a head coach in my first year. I overdid it in terms of trying to be the voice because you feel like you got to install everything, both X's and O and all that, and culturally. And it can be too much. And so I think the greatest lesson you probably learned, and again, college is different from the NBA. You got to know your audience.
Yeah,
you would have worn guys out if you come in as a head coach in the first year and you try to do that in the NBA, right? The NBA is about delivery and tone and short and sweet and less is more. And your ability to delegate and know that you still had guys relaying the message, even though you weren't always the one saying it, I think that's a great thing that you did in the first year. As opposed to, like you said, had you gotten the job over Jarrell, you probably would have overcooked it in that first year versus actually sitting back and seeing it, seeing someone actually delegate and model it for you.
Yeah. And I think the one thing is, and we've all been one seat over as the top assistant or whatever. I think you think when, all right, now it's my show, right? That I'm going to get to do everything the way I want to do it, which you can. But at the same time, as a first-time head coach, it's hard. It's hard to do everything, to your point. And it's hard to run all the offense and defense. It's hard to be the CEO, be bringing guys in every day to talk to them, to take their temperature, to see where their mind's at, right? You don't have that experience to be able to handle it all. And I think when you're one seat over as an assistant, you want to get to that chair to be a head coach because you get to control all that. But
right.
You can control all that while also having people, you know, taking on responsibilities and taking some of the delegation away from you, right? It's still ultimately your team. You're still ultimately responsible for what you run offensively, defensively, how the culture is, the schedule, all that stuff. And so if I would have, to your point, Mage, if the year before I would have tried to do so much because that's what I thought I should do, it probably would have been a disaster. And I still talk to Jarrell all the time. And I was so grateful for that year because first game of the year that year, we're playing College Park. And at halftime, we're talking about, hey, I think this action could work, whatever. He's like, all right, just draw it up. First play of the half, just draw it up. Draw it up, we score, whatever. But that's just how he was, right? And it taught me a lot about you got to have the humility to understand that you don't know everything and you can't do everything. It's just too much. And so when I went into that next year, Jarrell had me prepared so much for it that I thought the transition was really smooth and we had a really good year because of it.
So I got to ask this, going from the head coach to then being an assistant again, right? You go from being the head over in Maine to then being an assistant at Butler. Was that difficult? Now, granted, it's obviously it was going back to a familiar area, familiar people, so it probably wasn't too much of a transition, but was it tough for you to go from head to an assistant?
Yeah, I think it's always going to be, there's going to be some challenges with that. When you're the head coach, like I said, you still control everything. You still pick what time you practice. You still kind of control the subs. You still kind of, you have the ultimate say in everything, right? So I do think there is an adjustment period. Like Mage said earlier, Thad's so good at delegating. When he allowed me to run the offense and pretty much have full autonomy of it, we would talk and go back and forth on what we were kind of thinking. But ultimately, he would just kind of say, call the plays you want to call, draw up what you want to draw up, what drills do you want to do in practice. And so Thad was so good about delegating and put me in a role that I was really happy with, that it made it a lot easier. I have friends that have gone from being head coaches to assistants that they've struggled changing roles. So yeah, it can be challenging. And there are definitely times where it's not the easiest, but Thad did such a good job with how he delegates that it was a pretty smooth transition. And obviously I'm really thankful for that, because it could have been different.
The basic maybe three or four differences between the college game and the NBA game. And I think sometimes young coaches, obviously everybody's enamored with the NBA game, but there's obviously, it's a different game that's being played nuance-wise.
Yeah.
Obviously, the first thing everybody talks about is just the minus 6 seconds less than 24 versus 30. That's a base thing that's there. But talk about maybe a few nuances on either side of the ball that people probably wouldn't think about, or that young coaches that maybe listen to this and guys that are trying to progress in their career and they're just trying to learn the game better. Yeah. And especially as we're talking about this, it's playoff time, and it'll still be playoff time when this drops. So I think whatever you say is going to be pretty appropriate to help the people being better coaches as they watch the professional game.
Yeah, I'd say that offensively, one of the biggest things is the NBA is a ton of five out, space, pace, positionless, guys are all interchangeable, right? And I think that's good, but I think it's a little bit harder. I made that mistake probably my first year at Butler. The no defensive 3 seconds, I think, is something that you don't realize the impact of it when you go from the NBA to college. Even if you have to guard a non-shooter in the opposite corner, like, you're still having to 2-9 a little bit, right? If you just can't paint, they'll call egregious NBA 3 seconds, right? And in college, that guy can just
sit
on the opposite block if you wanted. Like, he can go so far over. And so I think that was a little bit of an adjustment for me when we wanted to try to space some non-shooters. It was really hard because they just don't have to guard them in college. And in the NBA, you still kind of have to be close enough that extra step and a half can really matter. I think the other thing is how quickly guys pick up stuff in the NBA. If you're doing, you might put in 2 or 3 simple actions, but actions that shoot around for a game that night. And in college, I felt like we had to 10, 15 minutes every day of 5-on-0. To make sure that when we got into environments with 10,000 screaming people or the game starts going really fast, that our guys could execute. In the NBA, it's just guys don't really get rattled, I would say. Like, they're able to remember it, whether there's 2 minutes to go in the fourth quarter or the other team's on a 16-0 run, right? They just, I don't know if that's from experience. I don't know what that's from, but you don't really see those guys mess up plays, struggle with the environment, all that stuff. And then I think defensively, it's just so different, right? Like, college, a ton of teams hard hedge, blitz. They're in aggressive ball screen coverage. If you try to do that in the NBA, it's the bigs are so good at catching it in the short roll. The guys passing it are so much taller, so much better passers that, like, not to do that as often, because then you're playing 4-on-3 a lot and they can exploit it. I remember my first year at Butler when we saw hard hedges. I was like, I haven't seen these in 8 years. And so I'm calling everybody and anybody, all right, like, you know, I think this is how you attack the hard hedge, but I haven't seen it so long. What am I missing? Right. Like, where are we falling short in terms of how we can be better? And so I just think that way it's so different. And then they've just, in the NBA, it's just gone so analytical heavy. And I think college is starting to catch up. If you look at the KenPom adjusted offensive efficiencies this year versus last, I think last year, if you were if you were like 40th, you would be 75th this year. But I just think their NBA teams are now crashing the glass at a higher rate. They're shooting more threes than ever. And I think that's now trickling to college slowly, but it's just very different in terms of the ultimate trying to win with math in the NBA versus college.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, in a sense, if watching Boston now, that's typically their thing, is to ultimately win the math game, right? Over the course of 48 minutes in terms of the volume of threes. Is that what you say, generally, if you just,
yeah,
and from, like, a Celtics approach?
Yeah. And like, when I was a head coach in Maine, I hired an analytics guy, which is another thing I did that was great. We were one of the first teams in the G League probably to have a full-time analytics guy, Alex Merg, who's now with the Celtics. And we just sent everybody to the glass. We sent everybody. The shooter shot it, tried to make it. Everybody else was running. Everybody. Didn't matter where you were. And I think we ended up second or third that year in offensive rebound and second and third in number of guys who crashed. And the Celtics have been really big on that this year. If you watch Peyton Pritchard, watch Baylor Sharman, Sam Hauser, some of those guys are crashing the glass every time. They're going hard trying to get rebounds. And so I think more shots, better shots was always Joe's message. Can we get more shots? Can we get better shots than the other team? And if we do that, our chances of winning will significantly go up. And so, yeah, I think that's starting. We emphasized it a ton this year at Butler, offensive rebounding, finished, I think, top 50. And so I just think that's going to continue to kind of slowly trickle down the college. But right now, it's been a big emphasis in the NBA.
I just want to ask, because you mentioned for obviously the Celtics, for Butler, you guys would instill everybody crashing the glass. Did that start to, or I guess, how did you counteract people leaking out off of that, or pass outs, fast break layups, opportunities, things like that?
Yeah, it didn't really hurt us. So it was more about the trade-off, right? If, let's just say, you add an extra 0.3 points per possession or 0.4 points per possession crashing, and you're giving up 0.15 points per possession additional in transition, the trade-off is your plus 0.25 points per possession, right? And so it wasn't so much about how many points we were giving up in transition. It was, is the trade-off worth that we are going to give up extra points in transition? And honestly, it really only bit us one time. I think we were playing Toronto, the Raptors 905, and somebody missed a shot like 20 seconds left and we all crashed and we didn't get it. And they got a leak out layup and they won. I think that was the game winning basket with 10 seconds left. And so sometimes you're going to get bit, but it was always about the trade-off of, the reality is it doesn't matter if you win 2-1 or 130 to 129, you just have to score more points than the other team. And so it was always the trade-off of, was this worth it? And the Celtics wanted us to use it as us to be a guinea pig in Maine that year. And yeah, we just went full bore with it. And it was pretty successful for us.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. I don't know. I heard this stat that I think it was Illinois this year. Instead of late clock trying to go get in the lane, they actually shot threes late clock, because they offensive rebounded like 42% of their late clock three-point misses, which led to kick-out horse shot threes.
Yep.
And so over the course of the year, they just were like, it's like playing the long game in golf with what you were saying about the transition defense. If you just keep enough shots in the fairway, we're gonna be fine.
Like, yep.
Once in a blue moon, you might end up in the weeds, and that's that one run out that gets you, but you can't overreact maybe to that one run out, because if it's one of those in 18 holes, then at the end, we're still going to be fine in terms of being close to par or whatever we wanted to do, as opposed to. So, but I thought that Illinois thing was impressive too, as far as what they did late clock, because most people think go get in the lane, go put it up on the rim, that type of thing. But they actually shot threes to try to create a three-point rebounding offensive advantage.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Illinois. So I've got a couple of buddies on staff there. And when we were struggling to make shots from three this year with Butler in conference, I was just like, hey, anything you guys got, like, we're getting pretty good luck, so we just can't make them. He goes, crash harder. And if you look at it last year, so not this past year, but 2 years ago, they finished, I believe, third in the Big Ten in offense. And they were 18th, I believe, dead last in three-point percentage. And they just killed teams on the glass. And so to your point, Mage, I think they've made such a big emphasis. And it's a unique thing. I never really thought about it, but shooting the late clock threes, you're going to increase your chances of getting a second shot. And that's actually – I'd never heard that or seen that stat, but that's actually really interesting. I think something that wherever I coach next, that may be – actually a really good point of emphasis with our guys.
Yeah, I heard him mention it in an interview. I think a reporter had asked about their three-point shooting or something, and their offensive rebounding somehow came up. But he actually transparently said, this is what we would try to do late clock, as opposed to getting in the lane. We're looking to shoot threes, because a lot of times either the weak side or the elbows don't get covered by guards blocking out for whatever reason. So you're able to go snatch those in there and then spray it right back out. And that immediate spray after an offensive rebound, like that's an offense within itself. I know we're getting into a bit of a basketball rabbit hole here, but like that immediate spray creates, it's such an opportunity to get a great three because the defense is in a preset scramble.
Yeah.
Because the ball's off the rim and you don't know, they're trying to get bodies on bodies, especially if it's after a driving kick three that created a rotation. So now, again, the scramble is already set. So you got a great opportunity to go in there and get another one. And then getting right to drive and kick again or swing again or whatever that looks like after the three-point miss. Those are the ones that can end up being daggers at times, depending on the course of the game, or just they're back-breaking in general. But if you have a huge one and it puts you up seven when you had a four-point lead, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
No, I think it's definitely unique to be able to see the change because at least when I played, we always had to have our point guard. The smallest guy was back, but then everybody else crashes. Another coach that I've worked for, he wanted two guys back. Everybody just has different tactics and weight, but I feel like things have evolved and I've never heard of, and that's why it's actually interesting to learn about, is all five crashing. Now, granted, I'm obviously more at the Division III level, so we don't really get too analytical because we don't have all of the stats and analytics that we can use. But it's definitely interesting to be able to hear that side as to all five crashing. Because I think it's pretty unique. But if you have the people that can crash and they are actually getting to the rim well, like that's obviously the thing. You can't just have people half-assing the crash. But if you have people getting in there, I think that's interesting.
Probably the thing, Alex, is that you got to go, right? If you're going, if you're crashing everybody, that's got to be a commitment thing because it's the guys that are drifting that kill you. If they're not, you should be running one direction or the other, basically. You're either sprinting. Sprinting to go crash or you should be going to sprint back.
Yeah, the Celtics call it getting stuck. You don't want to get stuck. And they have a get stuck percentage that we did in Maine, right? If you were in the corner. And there's Fred Katz did a great article at some point during the season about the evolution of offensive rebounding with the tagging up. And I think he's with The Athletic, but did a really great piece on just how it's evolved and talked to a bunch of different people throughout international basketball, the NBA, G League, like myself. He called and just kind of picked our brains on what our philosophies were and how they came about. And yeah, it's all part of as a coach, you're always learning and trying to grow and trying to find an edge to Mage's point earlier. Because if you can find an edge over the other team, it's going to give you a better chance to win. And ultimately, that's what we're all trying to do as coaches.
Get stuck percentage. I like that. You always hit the pause button on film. And there's that guy that's on the shots on the other side of the floor and he doesn't sprint in the lane, but he doesn't get back either. And he's in quicksand. And come on, man, you know, like one way or the other, be sprinting one way or sprinting the other. But if you're crashing five, that's an everyday thing. Definitely got to be commitment to it. No, that's interesting. I love it.
Coach Barlow, what we'll do is we'll get into a hot seat segment, which is just really all it is, a handful of questions just to get more live, what you feel, right?
Yep.
No, nothing too crazy, nothing too drastic, but more just advice and ways that the younger generation or people who are maybe out of positions or whatever it might be, give advice to them. So number one being, what are just some things that now you are currently doing? I know you mentioned you're looking for that next position and wherever you go, this will be something that you may help instill. But what are some things that you're doing now in between positions to try and help yourself get back into it?
Yeah, the first thing, I ran the offense the last 3 years at Butler. I'm going through our game plans from our worst games, starting with this year, and watching that footage and trying to see where we could be better, what we could have done differently. Was it a game plan thing? Was it an execution thing? Was it something that they did? So right now, just kind of going through that stuff and trying to grow and learn and see where ultimately I failed the guys or where we failed as a team in those games offensively.
Good stuff. Love it.
Trying to take what you did, change it, implement it, so then next year, learn from your own mistakes. That's great. That's great. And that's why you've been to the experiences and situations and you've risen in multiple programs. That tells you everything right there. It's just be as a somebody who, I should say, more – coach who has had some great experiences. You're still a young coach in the profession, but any advice you would give to your younger self before you rose in the profession, just getting into it, what would that advice be?
Yeah, I would say the biggest piece of advice I got, and I wouldn't have known if I hadn't had such a great mentor like Brad, was when you're a young coach, it's better to listen than it is to be vocal. My first 2 years with the Celtics, I barely spoke in meetings. I just didn't know anything, right? And my younger self, who's a confident guy, would have probably tried to give my opinion more so than I should have. But Brad kind of told me when I got there, hey, just soak everything in, learn as much as possible, be a great listener, and just kind of work your butt off, right? Do whether you're rebounding for, at that time, Isaiah Thomas was our best player, or whether you're rebounding for the 15th guy, just work hard for all of them. Don't be too good to only rebound for one guy, not the other. And those were the two pieces of advice he gave me. He said, just be a great listener and soak up as much as you can. And then it doesn't matter who or what is on the court or what you're asked to do, whatever task you're asked, just do it the best you can and work hard. And that's really kind of been a huge part of helping me get to where I've got.
Yeah, no, that always travels. Yeah,
great stuff. I love that advice, because especially there was a quote I saw recently, and it was the quiet man in the room is always, or I should say typically, is one of the smartest people. And the reason being is because the person who's talking obviously is spewing information they know, but the quiet person is sitting back and listening to everything and learning more. Whether they know it or not, they're learning everything else. So exactly to your point, just be the quiet man in the room, be able to be a sponge, learn all of that. That's great. And then the last question we have is just one thing that maybe you feel as players, whether we'll say when you were a player or as a coach coaching these players, one thing you feel like players do not focus on enough and should grow, and I should say do better, look to work on more.
Yeah, I think it's it's probably two parts, right? And I learned this from when I was at Butler my first year. I worked really hard. I was always in the gym, always trying to get better. And I was very blessed to work or play with the kid, Rodney Clark, who was redshirting that year. And he taught me how to work, right? Not necessarily like more about being efficient, right? Working on the right stuff, getting in the gym and not spending an hour and a half in there when you could get what you need to get done in 45 minutes, right? And everyone talks about this no days off. And that was the second piece I've learned from Rodney, but I also learned my time in the NBA, like becoming a great player and ultimately reaching your goals, there's as much non-court basketball stuff that goes into that than it does just no days off, right? Are you eating the right stuff? Are you getting treatment? Are you taking care of your body? Are you getting the proper sleep, right? We had lockout days in the NBA, right? Gyms closed, no one's allowed in except for treatment, right? And so many of these kids in college, a couple of our guys this year, I'd have to tell them, like, you're not allowed to come in today. I am not coming in. And if you come in and shoot with a manager, I'm not going to be happy. I'm going to be mad at you because you've gone for 27 straight days.
Right.
You need a physical and you need a mental break, right? And those guys in the NBA are the best I've ever seen at it. They know when they should be getting in and getting extra work, when they need a mental reset day. They're always getting treatment on their bodies, right? And I think that gets so lost with younger kids. They think if I just work super hard and do everything I can at a million miles an hour every single day, I'm going to get to where I want to get to. And it's not. It's not going to get you to where you want to get to. You need to work hard and be in the gym and love the game. But if you don't take care of your body and do all that stuff the right way, it's like the diminishing margin of the returns, right? You're just not going to get out of it what you're putting into it.
Well said, man. No, that's how
I couldn't believe that more. That is great advice. And that you're 100% right. My players, when I did it, I didn't prioritize it enough. Now everybody has more than enough equipment. They have all the boots you put on your legs and like everything. They have everything you need. And that's great advice. So for any players out there or coaches helping your players, take that right there. Get mental reset days and all that. That is great.
Yeah, no, it's professionalism. AB, this has been great, man. Dougie's about to land the plane, but I know we'll be talking soon here. Yep. Continued both luck and success. I know it'll just be a matter of time for you before something goes down. In terms of just great to have you back and kind of chop it up with your own personal journey. This has been really good, man. So thank you once again.
Thanks, guys, for having me. As always, I love coming on here, love talking hoops. And if any coaches are out there watching this, feel free to hit me on Twitter or Instagram or whatever if you have more questions or just want to talk. I've been blessed to have some great mentors that have always helped me navigate my journey. And part of this is for us to kind of help the next generation or help anybody that needs advice. So really appreciate you guys having me.
Of course. No, and thank you. Best of luck. moving forward. I know we'll be keeping an eye out for you, but yeah, we really do appreciate that. And everybody out there, we appreciate you for tuning in to another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Yours truly, Alan Major, Doug Caputo. All you coaches, keep working and keep rising. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.
Coach, are you still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.